Good morning and welcome to the Southwest Public Policy Institute's live screen panel on the future of education in New Mexico. I'm Megan De La Rosa, member of the Board of Directors for SPPI. Our mission at SPPI is to improve the quality of life in the American Southwest by formulating, promoting, and defending sound public policy solutions based on the principles of free enterprise, personal responsibility, limited government, individual freedom, and traditional American values. We are dedicated to delivering better living through better policy. SPPI is a 501c3 nonprofit charitable organization. Contributions to the Institute are tax deductible. Our work is sponsored by viewers like you. You can help us keep these events free. We invite you to consider making a contribution at southwestpublicpolicy.com/donate. Please join me in welcoming our panelists for today. Senator Craig Brandt, New Mexico Senate Minority Whip and a United States Air Force veteran. Craig and his wife, Tanya, live in Rio Rancho. Thank you so much for your service, Senator. Rebecca Dow, a former state representative and lifelong early childhood educator. Rebecca founded Apple Tree Educational Center, which provides much-needed educational services, including early education and comprehensive family support. And nationally renowned education reform advocate, Corey DeAngelis. Corey is a senior fellow at the American Federation for Children. He is also the executive director at Educational Freedom Institute, an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute, a senior fellow at Reason Foundation, and a board member at Liberty Justice Center. He was named on the Forbes 30 Under 30 list for his work on education policy. And now I will hand it over to the founder and president of the Southwest Public Policy Institute, Patrick Brenner, who will moderate today's panel.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Patrick Brenner. I'm the president of the Southwest Public Policy Institute. I appreciate you joining us today, whether you're on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, or YouTube. Please make sure you ask your questions in the comments field. Megan will be monitoring those, and we'll be sure to bring those up during the Q&A section toward the end of the discussion. So, Corey, let's kick this off with a little bit of a story time. Tell us about the state of education across the country in the aftermath of COVID lockdowns.
Well, we've seen the teachers unions held children's education hostage to secure multiple multi-billion dollar ransom payments from the taxpayers, and it worked for them. They traded in two decades of learning for $200 billion in so-called COVID relief funding, most of which hasn't been spent yet. According to the Wall Street Journal, 93% of the funding as of last summer hadn't been spent yet. The school closures always had more to do with politics and power than safety and the needs of children. And so we've seen a lot of learning loss in the aftermath of the teachers union induced school closures, what a lot of people call remote learning. I would call remotely learning. There wasn't a lot of learning going on. So families are trying to figure out what to do with their children and how to recoup all the learning loss. And one of the silver linings, however, is that the remote learning led to families getting more transparency into the classroom, whether intended or not. Families got to see that their kids weren't only reading, learning the basics, reading, writing, and arithmetic. They started to see that some of their kids were being taught values that weren't aligned with their family's values, which sparked another argument for school choice. And more parental involvement in education. So we've seen the year of school choice in 2021. A lot of states had a lot of victories there because of the parent revolution that has been sparked all across the country. We saw no red wave in the midterms, no blue wave, but there was a school choice wave. Education freedom advocates fared very well. If you look at the liberal tiers in the New Yorker magazine, they said that the education freedom candidates fared depressingly well in the midterms, which is bad news for people who want to control other people's kids, but good news for supporters of education freedom and parents who want more of a say in their own kids' education. Hopefully 2023 will be the year of education freedom with more school choice victories poised in multiple states all across the country.
So, Corey, let's get back to basics for those of us in the audience that don't know what school choice is. Tell us about school choice reform. What is school choice? What does it look like across the country? What does it look like in other states like Arizona? And what could it look like here in New Mexico?
Yeah, the way I would define it is allowing families to take their children's education dollars to the education provider of their choosing. So in the U.S. and in New Mexico, it's about the same. We spend about $15,000 per student per year in the government-run institutions. In the current system, all families have to take that funding to a residentially assigned government-run school. With school choice initiatives, that funding, $15,000 per student or a fraction of it, could follow you to the same institution if you want. If you like your public school, you can keep your public school, but for real, and like with the whole doctor thing. But if not, you can take that funding or a portion of it to pay for private school tuition and fees, or to send your child to a charter school, or to use it to cover home-based education expenditures such as curriculum or private tutors. What we've been seeing as kind of the new frontier of school choice is something called education savings accounts, where the funding that would have followed you to the government-run institution could still do that. But if not, it would go into an education savings account, which the parents could direct to take to private, again, private school tuition and fees, to send your child to a charter school, and to cover any other approved education expenditure. It's the concept of the money following the child, much like we already do with just about every other taxpayer-funded initiative. Think about with the Pell Grants for Higher Education. You could take the funding to the community college if you want, but you could also take the Pell Grant to a private religious or non-religious university. You can do the same thing with pre-K programs. You can take the funding, it's directed by the parent, to the private religious or non-religious education provider when it comes to preschool services for Head Start, for example, and other pre-K programs. With school choice, all we're arguing is that we apply the same logic to K-12 education to fund the kids directly as opposed to the buildings. And you can go on and on and on. We do this with Medicare. We can take the funding to a religiously affiliated hospital if you want. It's public dollars, taxpayer dollars that could be used at private institutions. We do the same thing with food stamps. We don't tell low-income families they must take that funding to a residentially assigned government-run provider of groceries. No, you can take the funding to Walmart or Whole Foods or Trader Joe's or any other provider.
So, Corey, let's take a look at what school choice looks like in Arizona. Arizona recently adopted the most comprehensive school choice program in the entire country. Tell us a little bit about your involvement in that and what it looks like for Arizona families today.
Yeah, Arizona just passed the gold standard of school choice policy. Like you said, the biggest school choice victory in U.S. history, what we've all been pushing for a long time, which is every single family, regardless of background, regardless of income, can take their kids' education dollars, it's about $7,000 per student in Arizona at the state level, to the education provider of their choosing, public, private, charter, or home-based education option. And they kind of started out a little more incrementally over time. They've had school choice for quite a while. Just last year, they had about 20% of the population eligible for the program. And this most recent expansion just busted it off and made the program available to all families, 100% of families, and which is how it should be in every state. I mean, the money is meant for educating the child, not for propping up and protecting a particular institution, whether it's public or private. The money belongs to the kids and their parents. They're in the best position to make those decisions for their kids. And the money doesn't belong to the government-run institutions. You should still be able to take it there if you want. The option should and is still on the table in Arizona and other states. But that's how it works in Arizona. It's an education savings account directed by the parents, available to everybody. And I will say, once they passed this in the past year, when the eligibility formally opened up in August of 2022, the parents actually broke the government website because so many parents wanted these alternatives. We now have, when it wasn't universal, there was about 12,000 or so kids who were enrolled in the program, having the money follow the child. Since they expanded it just a few months ago, there's over 40,000 to 50,000 students enrolled in the program already. You might say, oh, there's a million kids in Arizona public schools, but this is a large shift in a short amount of time. And it just goes to show you, I mean, we talk a lot about, oh, the polling is supportive of school choice. Nationwide, 72% of Americans support school choice. This is not a partisan issue. There's supermajority support among Republicans, Democrats, and independents. But the real test is, what happens when parents are given the option? And the revealed preferences in Arizona show that so many families aren't happy with what they're getting in the current system. That's a great argument to let everybody free.
Thank you so much for that explanation and the update on what's going on in Arizona. And you're on the ground in Texas, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Yep. Just moved out of the swamp from D.C. over to Texas in San Antonio. The Texas Federation for Teachers blocked me on Twitter. They're not going to be able to block me in person. So it's going to be fun pushing the ball forward this legislative session. It's a top 8 GOP legislative priority in Texas. Abbott has been leading on the issue like I've never seen before, saying earlier last year that this will be the biggest push for school choice in Texas history. I believe him. I sat with him in his office. I think it's going to happen finally in the state of Texas, school choice, private school choice program that they've never had before.
In your experience, you mentioned teachers unions. Have they been the biggest impediment and the largest obstacle to adopting broad-based school choice reform in the states?
Yeah, of course. They want to keep their gravy train going. They want to trap your kids in their government-run institutions that they staff so they can get the education dollars meant for educating them. I mean, it's totally a power grab. And this is why Randy Weingarten freaks out so much on Twitter and closes her replies all of the time, because they know their gravy train is coming to an end. Families have finally woken up. There's a new special interest group in town. It's not just the people representing the employees in the system. The kids have a union of their own, and they're called parents. They're pushing back at the school board meetings. They're pushing back at the ballot box too. And once more states get on this train of education freedom like Arizona, it's only a matter of time before every single state government school monopoly system domino begins to fall. Arizona's just the first.
Corey, thank you so much. You've been working with Senator Craig Brandt on his school choice bill here in New Mexico. So let's turn it over to Craig. Senator Brandt, if you wouldn't mind, let's start talking about your bill and what you anticipate being roadblocks here in New Mexico.
Roadblocks will be about the same as they are in every other state. So big difference between Texas and New Mexico is who controls the legislature. But we've seen other states where it's controlled by Democrats that have actually voted for and gone to school choice. So the bill that I'm going to be introducing will empower parents to choose what education system works for their children. And let's just be honest, who knows their children the best, or hopefully, right? That should be the parents. The parents want what's best for their children. They know what's best for their children. They should be able to make the choice of where their children go to school. They should be able to make the choice of where their children are going to get the best education. This will provide equity in educational opportunity. Right now, you're basically limited to where your zip code is as to whether or not your kids will be in a good school system or not. Even within Albuquerque, it has several zip codes. Your zip code will determine whether or not your children go to a good school. And that's going to determine whether they get a good education or not. We need to turn that control, we need to turn that power over to the parents so that they can have the greatest influence like they're supposed to. It rescues our most at-risk students by having your tax dollars follow the student so they can afford a high-quality education. PED will provide oversight of the program to ensure that tax dollars are being spent properly, and it actually puts the focus where it belongs. The focus will be on students, not on adults. Let's be honest. Our current education system in almost every state is focused on the adults. It's focused on the employees. It's focused on the superintendents. It's not focused on the children. And the mission of education is not to give people a job. You know, that's a nice byproduct, but the mission of education is to educate our students, not to give people a job. This bill will return the focus back to the children where it belongs, back to the students where it belongs. And that's why it's important for us to push forward with school choice in our state.
Thank you so much, Senator Brandt, for that introduction of your bill. Corey, you've seen a copy of Senator Brandt's bill. Does this get the Corey DeAngelo seal of approval?
Yeah, totally. I mean, look, it's an education savings account. It's the funding following the child to the education provider of their choice. And this would be a great step for New Mexico residents. This is what we're looking for.
Rebecca, let's take it over to you. I'd like to talk to you briefly about the education path that you and your husband have created for your children and the experiences that you've had, the obstacles that you've had to overcome personally from your experience as a parent, but then also how you've advocated for children at the state level in your time in the House of Representatives.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I grew up in rural New Mexico, truth or consequences. I went to college in Oklahoma, met my husband at college, and our kids were 3 and 5 when we decided to move back to truth or consequences and open up Sierra County's first full-time year-round childcare center. So by that time, I was really familiar with making educational choices for my children. I mean, children are learning before they're even born. You know, we know that's what study says. And so we were joining had a zoo membership and museum memberships. We were part of parents as teachers and home visiting groups. I was part of a formal mom's day out where we sort of had aligned values and play expectations when we got together. And so, you know, we got to Truth or Consequences and opened up Apple Tree Educational Center. It became like literally the only choice families had. And as my children entered school, during their K-12 experience, I raised 2 children in New Mexico. My husband and I would sit down with our kids, look at their educational goals. The research shows parents are the number one indicator of student success. Parents play a primary role in understanding their children and their children's needs. And for those 20% of children who are in at-risk situations, there is a difference. But for the vast majority of New Mexican children, parents know their children best. And so during our children's K-12 schooling, we made decisions for private school, public school, homeschool, and dual enrollment. And in that process, we found parents who agreed with us. Truth or Consequences, Sierra County has 12,000 residents. I think it's probably declining. I don't know what the current census says, between 10 and 12,000 residents. And we were able to create a small private school, nationally accredited K-12 private school. And not everybody could afford that because in New Mexico, that's completely private pay. You talk to folks who oppose school choice and they'll say, parents have choice. You just need money for choice. But that leaves the most vulnerable low-income children without options. So then we created Homeschool Co-op. And in that homeschool co-op, we just supported families in their choices. We'd come together for field trips or come together for different things. And in a rural community where there's 2 people per square mile, where you farm and ranch and then you rodeo and you have a rural lifestyle, which I support because they're putting affordable, high-quality food on our tables, we needed that homeschool co-op option. And these, it just kept going. I learned about dual enrollment, and it hadn't been something that had formally been implemented in my district. And so we brought community leaders together, including the local community college that was designated through the language, and brought dual enrollment. And so those are all school choices. And so when I ran for House of Representatives and I served in the House, you know, I really want to fight and advocate for what's best for children. And that's parents partnering with educators who understand and know students' needs. And these can be academic needs, social emotional needs, physical needs. So right now in New Mexico, when parents have a right, and where it's recognized at the state and federal level, is when their child has a special needs, Individuals with Disabilities Act, and the formal process of individualized education plan. But every child and every family should have that right to advocate and for dollars to follow children. I really like what was said earlier. When you're in the world of early childhood, you're practiced on looking at the needs of the whole child. And the whole child doesn't end when they go to kindergarten. You know, so looking at this comprehensive needs of a child, it has more components than one size fits all. We are living in a 21st century technology world. Children learn in different ways. And we're still in New Mexico. The people in control, the people who have power, the people in majority are insisting in a one-size-fits-all from an industrial evolution that has been demonstrated to meet the needs of, at best, 30% of the children in a classroom at any given time. Children get left behind when they do not understand and the lessons progress. And children who are gifted and advanced are marginalized as well. So you have this small, middle, you know, 30% is what they say statistically whose needs are met. And that's not good enough. It's not good enough when you're 51st in the nation, if you count DC. It is time for us to join with parents, educators, In my mind, school choice is choice for educators as well. People who want to innovate, people who have studied and looked at the research and the data and understand child growth and development and want to implement best practices and are being prohibited from doing so.
Thank you so much for that, Rebecca. I can tell that you are a passionate advocate for parents and children. We appreciate all the work that you've done over the last few years and all the work that we know you'll continue to do. And thank you for joining us today. I want to take it back to the audience really quick. Make sure you ask those questions in the comments sections on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube. I don't think we're live on Instagram, but we are live on all the other ones. Make sure you get those comments in so that we can add them to the Q&A section that we'll have toward the end of the discussion. So, Rebecca, thank you for telling us about that path for you and your husband and the path that you've created for your children. Craig, let's take it back over to you. I'd like to talk about the specific implications surrounding the Yazzie Martinez decision and the legal case there and the implications that it might have for school choice and a school choice effort in New Mexico. Craig, are you still with me?
Yeah, sorry, you were breaking up a little bit, at least on my end, so I didn't know who you were going to. Can you repeat the question? Sorry.
Let's talk about the Yazzie Martinez decision and the implications it might have for school choice in New Mexico.
Excellent. Well, you know, there's a lot of misconception about what the judge ruled in the Yazzie Martinez lawsuit. First of all, the judge found that our children are not receiving a sufficient education. Now, that was kind of a no-brainer finding, but especially our at-risk students. Rebecca mentioned a minute ago that we're 51st in the nation. Yes, we have 50 states, but they include DC, so that makes us 51st. That puts us dead last. We have 23% of our students that are able to read at grade level. 19% of our students can do math at grade level. Probably the lowest literacy rate we've ever had in our country is what we have right now. That's the system that we currently have that everyone wants to hold up and keep the way it is. The judge also ruled that more money is not necessarily the answer. Her ruling said that we needed to focus on targeted investments. The legislature's answer to that was to increase the funding overall and really almost do nothing when it comes to the targeting investments. So I don't think we've done anything really to comply. The other thing was that PED was not fulfilling their role in budget reviews or accountability for how at-risk funds are spent in the districts. So those were really kind of the three major points. I think it brings us back to, if the judge were still with us, I'd go and ask her. But I think she would agree with my statement that our system is currently focused on the adults and not focused on the children. We need to get our system back to, well, we need to get our system to being focused on the children, making sure their education is being is sufficient. It's not just sufficient, but it's quality education. You know, we keep just wanting to pour more money and leave the quality right where it is. In fact, you know, LESC right now wants to increase the amount of time your kids spend in a classroom and do really nothing about the quality. We can keep our kids in a classroom 365 days a year at the current quality, and they're not really going to gain anything because the focus needs to be on quality. Again, this, you know, I think, by providing school choice, you're saying, hey, parents, this is your responsibility. In fact, the bill, even when it comes to IEPs, would parents, when they sign it, the federal government says, you're saying that you're going to take care of all the needs for IEPs and that you're happy with what's being provided for you to do that. And so it really makes sure that the quality is there for our children, make sure the focus is on our children. Our state is never going to grow if we don't have a quality education for our children. And I have not seen in the 10 years I've been in the legislature or the 4 years before that, that I was on the school board, that are willing to really do anything to make sure that our children are the focus of education. We want to keep the focus on the adults. And we need to get that focus back to the children. I think that would help us comply with the Yazzie Martinez lawsuit.
So in funding students directly, instead of funding systems directly, as Corey has established for us in the chant of the parents at the national level, fund students, not systems, funding that funding mechanism, taking the funding directly to parents and families will create competition. And that competition between schools, public versus private, all of the competition that gets created really compels the individual schools to compete with one another and improve the educational quality in order to compete for students and dollars. Corey, can you tell us a little bit about what you've seen in at the national level and at individual state levels about the increased competition improving educational outcomes and educational quality?
Yeah, look, Senator Brandt is right. What better way to have targeted investments than targeting it directly to the students themselves and letting parents decide where to best meet the needs of their own children? But look, yeah, we just had another study come out on this topic from Ohio just a couple of weeks ago, and we now have 29 studies on the topic, and 26 of the 29 studies have found statistically significant positive effects of private school choice competition on the outcomes in the public schools too. So school choice is a rising tide that lifts all boats is a pretty clear strand of evidence. There's also a peer-reviewed meta-analysis on the topic by University of Texas at Austin researchers, Jabbar, J-A-B-B-A-R, and her team, published in 2019 in an education peer-reviewed journal. And they even find as well, when you pull all the effect sizes together, that competition has positive effects on the students who remain in the public school. So when you hear the union screeching that this is going to decimate the public schools, first of all, I like to ask them, well, why would that happen? Giving families a choice, why would that destroy any of the public schools if the public schools are doing a good job? They're essentially admitting that they don't believe it, or they're not confident in the public schools, and they don't think the families are happy. That's a good argument for choice, not against it. But it's even worse than that, because the reality is when families do have exit options, even if they don't exercise those exit options, it gives the public schools a stronger incentive to change and to allocate resources efficiently. And we've seen this on the teacher side as well. Someone else mentioned that school choice can be choice for teachers. Yes, teachers love being able to choose their employers as well. And during the pandemic period, a lot of teachers left the teaching profession out of the public school system and went and started micro schools, started to make more money in some cases, have a smaller class size and a lot more freedom, not having to deal with all the red tape in the government school system. But five studies on the topic that I've written about in a blog called School Choice Benefits Teachers Too at the Washington Examiner. All of these studies have found statistically significant positive effects of private and charter school competition on teacher salaries in the public school. Why? Because their employer currently, the district, has no incentive to allocate resources efficiently, so they spend it on administrative bloat and staffing surges. But when there's competition, they have to think about how to spend that money wisely. They put it into the classroom. They put it towards teacher salaries, and which, you know, teachers are the most important educational resource, which happens to be in the school. So this is a win-win solution that benefits teachers and students alike. And I also wanted to, I like how Rebecca pointed out that there's a lot of hypocrisy in these debates. I mean, a lot of the people who oppose school choice, they want to provide resources to low-income families for basically everything else, every other level of education, every other industry. But then when it comes to K-12 education, they all of a sudden adopt a pull yourself up by your bootstraps mentality that doesn't exist for any other policy. And the reality is the only difference there is when it comes to those in-between years of K-12 education, you have an entrenched special interest that profits from people not having a choice. They're called teachers unions and other unions who represent the adults in the system. And they fight as hard as possible against giving that choice to families so that they can take their kids' education dollars to providers that aren't staffed by their unions. And the unions disproportionately donate to Democrat politicians. That's just the reality. Look at Randy Weingarten, who I tussled with on Twitter a couple of days ago, who tried to lie about her role in keeping the schools closed. I mean, her union lobbied the CDC to make it more difficult to reopen schools in person. And New Mexico is one of the worst states on reopening schools. I believe it was, I mean, some measures have it had New Mexico even worse than California. If not, another metric I've seen had California worse than New Mexico, basically right there as well. But though, her union, 99% of the campaign contributions from her union, AFT, in 2022 election cycle went to Democrats. So it makes it really difficult for Democratic elected politicians to vote for school choice policies, even if their constituents support it by and large, which they do, even if they believe in private that it's the right thing to do. It has become very difficult because Democrats have backed themselves into a corner because they've become overly reliant on campaign contributions from the teachers unions. But like I said earlier, that political power dynamic has shifted because there's a new special interest group in town. They're called parents. They've woken up. They're never going back to sleep. And politicians from all parties would be wise to listen to these new members who are paying attention and watching them, which happen to be parents. And we're seeing some Democratic elected officials reading the tea leaves in other states, at least. We have Josh Shapiro, who's now the governor-elect of Pennsylvania. Right before the election, he quietly changed his education platform to include education savings accounts, like the one proposed by Senator Brandt and passed in other states as well. J.B. Pritzker of Illinois, who won his election pretty handily. 3 weeks before Election Day last year, he answered a survey supporting a tax credit scholarship private school choice program that he vowed to get rid of when he was running for governor the first time. Why are these politicians switching on the issue? I don't know if it's because of a real change of heart or because they're reading the tea leaves, but it doesn't matter what the reason is. As Milton Friedman once famously said, it's not about getting the right people into office. It's about making it politically profitable for the wrong people to do the right thing. And I believe we're reaching a point to where it's becoming politically disastrous to oppose education freedom, and it's becoming politically advantageous to support parents because the parents are paying attention. And as far as the hypocrisy, there is no limits. I mean, if you follow me on Twitter, you see me point this out all of the time. A lot of the same people who oppose school choice for low-income families, they send their own kids to private school. Think about Joe Biden. He exclusively attended private schools and sent his kids to private schools. That's great for him, but you shouldn't fight against school choice for less advantaged families. Governor of New Mexico said on her campaign website that she was a product of the New Mexico public school system. She forgot to point out that she graduated from a private school, which is great, but other families should have that opportunity as well. I don't know if anybody's seen the movie 8 Mile, but at the end, the final rap battles to Eminem movie, he says something, you know, Eminem says something to Papa Doc, who's his opponent. And he goes, I know something about you. You went to Cranbrook. That's a private school. And it's kind of the mic drop moment at the end of the movie. Bill Prady from, what is it, the Big Bang Theory producer, he actually got into a tussle with me over this on Twitter. And I found on Wikipedia that he went to Cranbrook. So it was a perfect moment to respond with the 8 Mile meme where Eminem's throwing the mic at Papa Doc. But it happens all the time. It's like anytime I look into this, it's always the case.
So, Corey, thank you so much. I really appreciate the pop culture references. Makes us hip. And let's kick it back over to Rebecca. Rebecca, you are known as an advocate for school choice reform. Given the continued decline of educational quality in New Mexico schools and public schools in general, tell us what you see as a path forward for education reform in New Mexico.
Well, I mean, like the ideal circumstances would be the educational savings account, Arizona is doing, where dollars literally follow the student. But I think folks who sign up and listen to this and who want to get engaged in this upcoming 60-day legislative session should definitely support the education choice bills. But I think there's things like, do parents know what their rights are when maneuvering the current public system? Do they know that their children, if they're in a failing school district, which is, there are a few exceptions, but for most case, every parent with a child in a public school has a right to take their child to a different school within that district or in any other district if their child's school is considered Title I or not on track for their students to succeed. Do they know what their rights are in knowing what curriculum is being offered and opting out? Like these things in the current circumstances that we have in New Mexico, I mean, 36 states have school choice, And for whatever reason, New Mexico, who continues to be last in the nation on everything, has chosen not to do so. And I hope the tide is turning. We have the opportunity to take 529s. And that traditionally was a savings account that provided a tax credit for parents just for college. That's been expanded to include K through 12 schools, but also to include career technology pathways. So families who have students who are not college bound can use those savings for technical and trade, cosmetology, real estate license, and also K-12 private school. You know, there are innovative things that states are doing, as simple as allowing kids to get their PE credit outside of the school day. We all know families, or maybe you're one of them, whose kids are in a very competitive swim team or soccer, or maybe they rodeo in rural New Mexico, or they're part of a karate or gymnastics. Well, if they can demonstrate those outcomes and show and log their hours, then they can get that credit applied during the school day, applied to their credits, not have to take PE classes during the school day, and can focus on other more classes, core classes, financial literacy, maybe one more upper level science class. So giving parents choices. I think we have a real opportunity right now, and I hope that all of the elected officials pay attention to the COVID funds. Those are federal dollars that have been distributed to our state, and they cannot be, they cannot prohibit homeschool and private school kids in New Mexico from participating. So an example would be tutoring. The tutoring for COVID recovery. We all need to be advocating that all students are included. Michelle Lujan Grisham chose to apply the COVID standards to non-public schools, even though they don't receive a dime, and therefore children in non-private school and non-public schools were also prohibited from learning and were separated. And so now these COVID funds that are supposed to help students gain that loss should also apply to private and homeschool children. Not only because it's the law with federal dollars, because it's the right thing to do. So if state dollars are put towards that, we need to advocate. And perhaps most importantly is the land grant permanent fund. We passed a constitutional amendment. And right now in New Mexico, our early childhood system that happens prenatal until children go to school is a mixed delivery model, meaning that it can be happening at a church or in a home or in a Montessori, and parents choose. And we need to make sure that that stays a mixed delivery model and that it doesn't become something that only can happen in a public school setting. That would be going the wrong direction. So parents need to be able to choose those early childhood experiences in a way that is meaningful for them. And some people live in Albuquerque, they commute to Santa Fe, and they consider that time with their child in the vehicle, driving to Santa Fe and dropping them off at a center in Santa Fe as critical learning time. And the research would back that up, because parents and the social emotional relationship, the bond with their child, has protective factors and has beneficial factors that set children up for success. So we should advocate for the continuation of a mixed delivery in our early childhood model. It's one of the things we're not ranked last in.
Sure. So how does the universal pre-K program that was just passed and approved by Congress for tapping the New Mexico's permanent fund, how does that play in?
Well, that's exactly what I'm talking about. We haven't done the enabling language yet. And so what has happened over the past 20 years, you know, this was just starting when I opened up early childhood program in Truth or Consequences, this idea of tapping the permanent land grant fund for early childhood. It's been something that's been going on for a very long time. And in the meantime, we established New Mexico Pre-K, only bill in the nation where half of the money stays in the private setting and half goes to PED. We're already out of compliance with that. This governor is putting more and more in PED. We are non-compliant in that statutory mandate to have a 50-50 split of funding distribution. Then we established that sunset and was re-established, reaffirmed by this body that they want a mixed delivery model. Half of the money going to non-public school settings and half of the money going to public school settings. Then when we established the Early Childhood Agency, it was reaffirmed again that New Mexico wants a mixed delivery model. So we just need to be vigilant in this the enabling language that it remains a mixed delivery model. What happens is, you know, parents don't wake up and decide their one-year-old needs full day year-round early childhood programming. They need to work or go to school in order to better their family, to put a roof over their heads. And they look for an early childhood program that reflects their values, meets their needs, is affordable, is high quality. Lots of different reasons why they choose where and who they choose to care for their young children, including relative care in our state. So we have a beautiful it's very reflective of our culture, a very diverse, beautifully diverse early childhood system in New Mexico that happens in rural communities and homes, in co-ops, in what would be considered micro schools, settings of less than 30 children, in faith-based programs, and a variety of theories of practice that are all licensed and approved by the state and managed through the Early Care and Education Department. We need to continue to move forward with the mixed delivery model. The language matters.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. I appreciate your insight into that very much. I wish you were still up in the legislature and we could be working together on some of this, but c'est la vie.
You don't have to have a title to be an advocate, so I appreciate this opportunity.
We're here together, yes. Corey, you mentioned some national polling on school choice. I wanted to chat with you really quick about the national, the polling directions, the parents deciding that school choice is right for them and expressing that in some of these national and state level polls. I know Idaho and the Mountain States Policy Center up in the Pacific Northwest came out with their own polling on the issue, highlighting the fact that a lot of parents just don't know about their options when it comes to school choice and don't know what school choice is. The Southwest Public Policy Institute conducted our own polling of parents at Albuquerque Public Schools specifically. We surveyed over 600 parents and found that 75% of parents wanted to take their children to a charter school, not knowing that charter schools are in fact free and that have different application periods. Tell us, where do parents stand nationally?
Yeah, I mean, your polling appears to align with the national scene as well. The latest Real Clear Opinion Research polling finding 72% of Americans supporting school choice with supermajority support among Republicans, Democrats, and Independents. And that number ticked up 8 percentage points since it was done in April of 2020. So we've seen, again, this parent awakening over the past couple of years. It's been a huge shift towards support of education freedom nationally. And then there's been little pockets of different polls and things on the ballot in different states as well. In Texas, where I live now, they actually put it on the Republican primary ballot. It was proposition number 9, and they found that 88% of Republican primary voters in Texas support school choice. And that was up 9 percentage points since they last put it on the ballot in 2018. So it went from 79% support to 88%. Percent support among Republican primary voters. That's not overall. But they also did, there was also a poll at University of Texas at Tyler and one other finding majority support for school choice at it's a university-based poll among Republicans, Democrats, and Independents in Texas as well. In Georgia, they had it on their Republican primary ballot as well, and they found about a it was about a 5 percentage point uptick in the past couple of years with nearly 80% of Republican primary voters supporting school choice in Georgia, too. I think it went from 72% to 79%, if I remember off the top of my head correctly. So there's been shift in the polls. There's been shift. The political winds have shifted as far as parents making school choice a voting priority in certain states. And it's just become more politically disastrous for family or for politicians to say things like, I don't think parents should be telling schools what they should teach. Like we saw in the Virginia gubernatorial race where Terry McAuliffe slipped up and let the mask slip at his at the final debate against Glenn Youngkin, who won on the issue of education by 6 points with education voters and by 2 points overall. And education was the number two issue in that race. So this is. He kind of laid out a blueprint for success for Republican candidates in particular. The more that the Republicans lean into parental rights and education, the more politically disastrous it becomes for Democrats to oppose it. And I think that's the path towards widespread bipartisan support among elected officials. It has to hurt at the ballot box because whether we like it or not, politicians respond to power as opposed to logic some of the times. And the way to get both parties to support it, I think, is for the Republicans to lead on the issue like they have. They've essentially become the parents' party in so many places. The more that Republicans win on it, the more Democrats are going to have to defect and come along as well, like we saw in Illinois and in Pennsylvania. I think Josh Shapiro was looking over at Virginia and saying, I don't want that to happen to me. I might as well support education savings accounts too. And look, this has kind of been the case with things like Medicaid and Pell Grants as well. Things that used to be one party leading on the issue have become more widespread, supported in a bipartisan fashion. I think that's the path forward for school choice as well. And look, yeah, we've seen 2021 was the year of school choice. 2022 in the midterms was the year of the parent. Hopefully 2023 is the year of education freedom with more states empowering all families like they did in Arizona.
There was a member of the House of Representatives in Virginia that introduced a bill at the United States Congress. I want to talk just briefly. If Congress, the United States Congress, passed legislation that could Congress pass legislation that compelled states to fund students, not systems? What would that look like?
They can. There's a, you know, the Democrats control Senate still. The House Republicans are going to the Republicans are going to be in control of the House. The Republicans did include in their Commitment to America agenda school choice. So they should, they've got the majority in the House now. They might as well pass a school choice bill through the House of Representatives at the federal level. There's a couple ways to do this. One is through a tax credit mechanism where if a state implements a school choice program, their constituents or their residents in the state could go to scholarship granting organizations and get the funding that's donated to those scholarship granting organizations, which provides a tax credit to families, get scholarships to take it to a private school. It's an indirect way to fund an education savings account. The way that I explained it earlier is very simple. It's the most simple way to do it is to redirect the funding that's already there from buildings to the families. The tax credit mechanism provides a financial incentive to donate to these scholarship granting organizations. You get a tax benefit for doing so. Other families will go to those scholarship granting organizations, get the funding, apply for the funding to receive the funding, and then spend it at private school for tuition and fees or any other approved education expenditure if you do it through an education savings account mechanism. So there's the, I believe it's the Educational Choice for All Act. Senator Bill Cassidy has a version. There's a House version as well. Senator Rand Paul has the School Act, which is the more simplistic way to do it, which is just redirecting all of the federal funding. About 9% or 8% of total K-12 education funding comes from federal sources. Rand Paul's bill, the School Act, would just allow families to shift that money from the buildings to their families to choose private school tuition and fees or any other approved education expenditure. It's not as likely to happen because the Democrats control the Senate, but, and it's a more, most of the action that we've seen has happened at the state level. I'll just put it that way. The only federal school choice program we have at the moment is for the DC Opportunity Scholarship Program. It's a federal district, but that's another example of a place with a lot of constituents who are Democrats that have private school vouchers, and they've had it for quite a while now. There's actually a nice Netflix documentary on it called Miss Virginia, if anybody wants to check it out. A lot of people refer to Waiting for Superman when they want to hear about a good documentary about school choice. That's a great one, but I think Miss Virginia is actually even better, and it's on Netflix if you want to check it out.
All right. Sounds great. You heard the man. There's your Netflix prescription from Dr. DeAngelis.
Even if you don't support school choice, it's just so well done. So show it to your Democrat friends and maybe they'll come along too.
So I want to end this with a couple of questions for our Q&A. So we're going to toss this back over to everybody. So feel free to chime in. One of the big concerns that we see in New Mexico is this objection that rural New Mexico will not benefit from a comprehensive school choice program. From a concerned parent in Southeast New Mexico, they say school choice is really unfair to small poverty districts like Lake, Arthur, and Hagerman. We are the choice. And when public school funding goes somewhere else, the rich become richer and the poor become poorer. What Gateway and Sydney Gutierrez do is if you aren't elite, smart, and athletic, they run you off anyway. Our parents wouldn't even have a chance of driving there because they don't have a car or money for gas. So the question is, how can we address the concerns of a school choice program defunding rural schools?
Yeah, so the money doesn't belong to the government schools in the first place, so you're not defunding anything. If anything, the traditional school system defunds families. School choice initiatives just return the money to the hands of the rightful owners, or at least the intended beneficiaries of that funding. But look, the rural areas have the least to worry about. I mean, if they have the fewest exit options, the legislators in those areas have the weakest argument against school choice, because if your main concern is that the public schools are going to lose some money, well, if families don't have a lot of places to go, you're in the area that should not have a lot of problems if families don't have any other choices, like you say. The thing is, families will be able to find other options with the education savings accounts. They can have a micro school, even if a private brick and mortar school doesn't exist, homeschool co-ops, homeschooling. You can purchase homeschool curriculum with education savings account funding. And on the question of transportation, you can use education savings account funding for transportation to get to the school as well. So that takes care of that. But even if it didn't, I mean, every little bit helps. And this is a step in the right direction towards empowering more families to have educational opportunities. I mean, ask these same people, would they oppose Pell Grants just because the Pell Grant doesn't give you a car to drive to college? Would they oppose food stamps just because food stamps don't give you a stipend to pay for a car to get to the grocery store? No. I mean, this just because you don't cover everything doesn't mean it's not an equalizer, which it is. The most advantaged already have school choice. They can already afford to live in the neighborhoods that are assigned to the best public schools. They can already afford to pay for private school tuition and fees out of pocket. I mean, you'll hear a similar argument with the same line of apparent logic, where they'll say, you know, New Mexico public schools spend $15,000 per kid or whatever the number is. This bill is only the state portion, so it's what, $6,000 or $7,000? That's not enough to cover private school tuition and fees. My first response is, well, yeah, it is. And you're only looking at the most expensive private schools. It can help you afford the lower cost private schools. And I'll ask them, well, would you oppose Pell Grants just because it doesn't cover the full cost of attending Harvard? Would you oppose or do you support an amendment to my bill? You point out to have the full amount of funding follow the child, have the local funding follow as well. Then they'll say, no, then you're stealing more money from the public schools. So that's their only argument. It has nothing to do with affordability of the private schools.
Craig, I'm going to kick it over to you.
Yeah, and Corey's got a lot of that right. But actually, in New Mexico, we don't have local funding. So everything's coming from the state. So actually, the full $17,000 would be available. You know,
or
to
in the case
parents.
Of Albuquerque Public Schools.
So we actually don't have a local funding mechanism, with the exception of building the buildings. So you can bond to build buildings, but actually for the operational expense, that all comes from the state government in this state. So we're a very unique state in that way. You know, as far as this argument, again, I think it goes back to what I was saying before. And I appreciate the concern of the rural district. However, all my rural legislator friends tell me that they're the best schools in the state. So I'm not sure why that would be a concern, because those parents are pretty happy with the kids in that school. But we're focusing on the wrong thing. Education isn't about being an employer. Education isn't about the employees. Education is about students getting a quality education. And we need to focus on how do we do that for every student in the state, not just for one or two. And again, the rich already have this opportunity. Why are we bringing this bill? To make sure that everyone is brought to that same level, to make sure everyone has access to high quality education. So every child in New Mexico has the opportunity to get a quality education, go on to college if that's their role, or go out and get a good job. In other words, every student has the opportunity to succeed.
I mean, we see the same argument in Texas, because there's a lot of rural areas in Texas. They'll say, we have Republican majorities, but we don't need to do school choice because we have rural areas, so we get a pass. We can side with the establishment. But then I've pointed out on Twitter, the 9 most rural states, according to the U.S. Census Bureau data, they all have some form of private school choice program. Texas does not. And in fact, the some of the couple most rural states, including West Virginia, but they have the most second most expansive education savings account program in the nation right now. They're fine. And two of the most rural states, Maine and Vermont, have some of the longest standing voucher programs in the country that started in the late 1800s, specifically designed for students in rural areas that don't even have public schools. They created a voucher for students because, oh, well, the state didn't make the schools in those areas. And you can use the voucher to attend a public school in a nearby district, or you could use it for private education as well. So the rural argument is just an excuse, a convenient excuse to side with the establishment and to come out against a party platform issue in deep red states. And that this has been the main impediment to school choice in places like Texas over time. But then they'll also say things that are logically incompatible with one another. I'm sure you guys have all seen the two button meme where the guy's sitting there looking at two buttons and he's sweating profusely, trying to figure out which one do I press because you can't press both of them. And one of the buttons, I've kind of posted this on Twitter a couple of times, is we can't use school choice because we don't have a lot of private schools. This won't benefit us. And then in the next breath, they'll say school choice will decimate rural public schools. You can't say both of these things at the same time. Which one is it? If people really can't use your program, this isn't going to decimate your schools. You have least to worry about when it comes to families getting exit options. But at the end of the day, and then, yeah, they'll also say that we have great rural schools. These are the lifeblood of our community. And it's like, if that's the case, then you shouldn't be worried about any little bit of competition doing anything to your schools. And my other question to them is, well, why would this happen? Why would giving families a choice decimate your schools? And I usually get blocked at that point because there's no good answer to it. It's either an admission of failure, or they'll say something even worse, which is goes even more viral. They'll say, well, the public schools are actually better, but these low-income parents, they just don't know any better. And that's just the paternalistic worst argument against school choice that I've ever heard. Parents know and care more about their kids more than anybody else, certainly more than bureaucrats sitting in offices hundreds of miles away.
Rebecca, you are from a rural area of New Mexico. Tell us your thoughts.
Well, I think that, we've had charter schools in New Mexico for quite a while, and that includes online charter schools. So if there would have been a mass exodus from rural schools in New Mexico, families could have already joined online charter schools. And I do think in these small communities, you know your teacher, you're probably related to them. It's even difficult to get school board members that aren't related to people who are employed or administration in school districts. So, I mean, there is this, you know, these are the people you see at lunch. These are the people that you go to church with. And so there is that close knit. And I think there's a fear factor that isn't founded in reality, even in states statewide, when school choice happens, real school choice happens, less than 20% of people choose a private school. They will choose another public school. They will choose another charter school. So there's not this mass exodus that people believe there is. And that's even a smaller percentage in rural communities. And New Mexico, wisely, we had what was called the small school funding formula. We revised that to a rural school formula. I think there needs to be some work on that formula because it hurts a particular school in my district. And I think about these rural communities. Right now, there is a very big push at the state level to extend the school day and to make it year-round. My community is an ag production community. These kids are already an hour away, sometimes an hour away from the bus stop, and the bus stop is an hour away from school. They're getting on a bus before the sun comes up. They're getting home after the sun goes down. They have chores to do, and their families like to spend time with them, and they like having summers off, and they like breaks. And so there are more and more mandates coming from the top down. And so we have to at least be a voice on school choice saying, you know, there should be 4-day school weeks. There should be options to have a traditional school year. Kids should be able to demonstrate their competency outside of an extended day or year-round learning. These things matter, particularly in rural New Mexico, where we can continue to celebrate and protect a culture and an industry that puts affordable food on our table. So in New Mexico, I want to advocate for school choice in the public school in how many hours and how many days out of the year your children have to be in school. But I think about there are demonstration sites in tribal areas where culture and heritage and family and their traditions were important, their native language. And they were able to do self-demonstration and use these dollars to create small local schools close to home. And it increased their students' understanding and their ability to accept and to celebrate their diverse heritage. Kids drive a long way in rural communities to get to school, but not everybody has a school that's close to their home. And so I think that one size never fits all, and therefore all options for families should be on the table.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. We're going to close it out at this point. Thank you so much for joining us, everyone, today. We appreciate you tuning into the live stream. Rebecca, Corey, Senator Brandt, thank you so much for being here. I appreciate you taking the time. I know Megan isn't here anymore, but thank you so much for making the introductions. Ladies and gentlemen, help us keep these events free. I invite you to make a generous gift to the Southwest Public Policy Institute today at southwestpolicy.com/donate. Again, I appreciate you joining us today so much, and stay tuned for more information on school choice. Stay tuned for more information on Senator Craig Brandt's school choice bill, and we'll see what we can get done during this next 60-day legislative session starting January 17th. Have a great day. Thank you.